Thanks very much for the invitation to visit. Okay, so I thought I'll this would be a little bit more observationally oriented talk, although I started out as a theorist, but in the past 5 years I had sort of become a part-time observer, and I'll explain that in a second. Okay, so I thought I'll first motivate the scientific reasons for studying supermassive black holes, especially at a very, very high mass end. That would be the focus of my talk. And just to get started, obviously, when you mention black holes, this is the obligatory slide, the beautiful LIGO measurement. I just want to stress that these are stellar mass black holes. We're talking about black holes of tens of solar masses. In this case, a beautiful binary. Okay. But if you go beyond stellar depths, you can ask, what is the other type of astrophysical black hole that we know about? So today I would like to focus on the supermassives. And these are believed to have been formed very differently. We don't know how they're formed. They're definitely not the end of a stellar evolution, but rather probably some initial gas collapse or the mergers of many, many smaller seed black holes. Okay, I will not be talking about the seeds today. They themselves are interesting questions to probe, but rather I'll focus on the very, very local, sort of within 100 megaparsecs. What do we know about these black holes? Okay, the best example of a supermassive black hole is the one at the center of our own Milky Way. And this is, when I first saw this image, I thought it was so beautiful, I thought it was an artist rendition. This is actually the COBE satellite picture in the infrared of our own Milky Way. So we're obviously not living at the center, and you're looking towards the spheroidal component, the bulge of the Milky Way with a beautiful disk polluted by dust. And so I'm making it very, very hard to see in the optical. A lot of observational efforts toward the galactic center have been successful in the infrared. Okay, and there have been by a couple of groups, Andrea Ghez at UCLA and Reinhard Gentel at Max Planck. He's also part-time professor at UC Berkeley. They have been doing over decades measurements of individual stellar orbits very, very close to the galactic center. And they have been able to measure the black hole mass to quite great precision. And it's coming out to be 4 million solar masses, way, way, way bigger than the stellar mass black holes. But as I will show you, among the supermassives that we know, this one was really puny. Okay? And just to give you the distance, this is the closest supermassive black hole known at our own galactic center. That's at about 8 kiloparsecs. Okay? So if you compute the angular size subtended by the event horizon of a 4 million solar mass black hole on the sky is 10 microarcseconds. It's a tiny, tiny angle, but probable by radio interferometers. And the event horizon telescope, some people here work on that, is targeting this black hole and the next one I'll talk about with the hope of actually looking just around, resolving the event horizon. It has quite a remarkable achievement to be able to get to such a small angular size. Okay. But again, I'm not talking about this well-studied black hole, but rather I want to move beyond our own galaxy. Okay. So the next best-known supermassive black hole is much, much bigger than this one and is much, much more distant. And this had been known for more than 30 years by now. And it's at the center of the giant elliptical galaxy M87, Messier 87. And M87 anchors the gravitational potential of the famous Virgo cluster, a cluster of many, many galaxies. You can see now that the distance is way, way, way beyond 8 kiloparsecs, is at about 17 megaparsecs. Okay, so it's 2,000 times more distant than the Milky Way black hole, and it's weighed at 16 billion solar masses, and so it's 1,000 to 1,500 times more massive than the Milky Way black hole. So if you compute the event horizon, it's comparable, right? Five to seven, depending on which measurement you use. Okay, there are actually two measurements in the literature. The Welsh et al. Is at 3-ish billion solar masses using a different tracer. Okay, I'll not get into that detail today. But just to highlight that this is the second target for the Event Horizon Telescope, trying to probe the surroundings of the black hole. Okay. So for about, so the first sort of paper that pointed to the possible existence of a black hole at the center of this giant galaxy was led by Wall Sargent and in the 70s. And their data, of course, they did their best, was really, really difficult to, the way you study these black holes is the galaxies are way too distant to use individual stellar orbits, unlike the one in Milky Way. We have the privilege of doing that just because that's our galaxy. When you go beyond that, you are measuring the dynamics of some luminous tracer, obviously. Stars are usually probably the cleanest tracer. You could use ionized gas. You could use masers. You could use carbon, you know, a molecular gas or so on. But this is based on stellar, so you try to resolve integrated light, okay? So you're not doing individual star orbits, but integrated light from stars very close to the hole also give you sufficient information for you to measure their dynamics to weigh the black hole. Okay, so I don't think their data were quite as good as today's data, obviously, but they incredibly, they got a mass that's right on, okay? So I got into this game sort of 5 to 8 years ago. Let me just first tell you what we have found since, okay? And so we went beyond M87, and I'll explain that later, but let me just show you what's known right now. So this was when 2011, my student led the paper, that we went beyond the Virgo cluster. So this is the Coma cluster, which is at about 100 megaparsecs now. Okay, so we are 6 times more distant than the Virgo cluster. And this black hole had somewhat large error bars because our this was the very first one we were able to, you know, get good enough measurement for. And again, I'll talk about that. And also, this is a slightly complicated galaxy. Okay, but so we put it between 15 to 20 billion solar masses for the black hole. And NGC 4889 is the biggest galaxy in the Coma cluster, which is the biggest cluster in this volume. Okay, so Coma is several times more massive than Virgo. So in some sense, we found the biggest black hole in the biggest galaxy, in the biggest cluster, in this local volume. And in some sense, that's not surprising. Based on the hierarchical structure formation, okay, that's sort of the pattern we expect. And many simulations and theorists have studied this, how you grow black holes in galaxies through mergers and so on. What was difficult in this one is to get a good enough spectroscopy to measure the black hole mass. Okay, if I move further on, so earlier last year, so we continue to study this, and we have been pursuing a more systematic survey called the MASSIC survey. I'll describe a bit later. But one outcome of that systematic study, rather than targeting the biggest thing on the sky, we thought we needed to be more, you know, just more systematic. So out of the survey, we found another comparable size black hole, but with a much smaller error bar. The formal error bar is only about 10%. There are, of course, systematics that are hard to quantify, okay? And it's at 17 billion solar masses. And this, because the system is quite simple and the data we happen to get were quite nice. So this black hole is at a less famous galaxy called NGC 1600, okay, unlike 4889, which most astronomers know about. And it's in this group of galaxies, okay, called the NGC 1600 group. It doesn't even have a special name. It's actually closer than Coma, so it's 50% closer. It's at about 64 megaparsecs rather than 100. Okay, and it was one of the 100 surveyed galaxies we have been studying. And the black hole mass turned out to be comparable. So if you calculate the event horizon, it's actually comparable to M87. So if this has, as a big if, okay, this is a pretty quiescent galaxy, if it has some millimeter emission, this could become a third candidate for the Event Horizon Telescope. And our survey is promising many more measurements. So anything of this size and this distance, okay, could become very interesting down the row for that experiment. But what made us pretty excited about this source was the environment. Okay, so if you put 1600 and COMA side by side, these are two just images on the same physical scale, so that bar is 100 kiloparsecs. Okay, I just want to contrast that we got two comparable mass black holes living in a very, very different environment. The COMA, again, the virial total dark matter mass is extraordinary. It's a few times 10 to the 15th. There are very few halos of this mass, and as you know, the mass function of anything in astrophysics falls off exponentially. Okay, so it's a very rare, extraordinary object, very bright in the X-ray luminosities, and 4089 has a friend, 4874, which is just slightly less luminous than 4089. So it's a big cluster with two nuclei. Okay, and recently we were able to get data for 4874. I'll show you that later. But contrast that with the 1600 group. The virial mass is a little harder to measure because this is not a very well-studied group, but we have velocity dispersions from the two-mass redshift survey. So it's probably about 10 times less massive. So they're much, much more abundant, okay, in terms of halo mass. But the X-ray luminosities, which tended to is another barometer for the gravitational potential, is much, much less luminous. And what's striking also is the second brightest galaxy in this group is at least three times fainter, okay, unlike the COMA cluster, where you got twins, basically. And when the secondary is so much fainter, sometimes people call these objects fossil groups. They believe that the central galaxy may have grown at the expense of their friends by swallowing them up through mergers. Okay. That's one possible explanation for why 1600 had become so bright, okay, so massive to actually make into our massive survey and to host such a massive black hole in a fairly modest environment. It's not the voids or isolated, okay, but it's really a much more common environment. So we kind of call COMA sort of the skyscrapers in Manhattan, and NGC 1600 group is more like a small town, okay. Okay, so why this is true, I think this is, I don't have an answer. Maybe it's just stochastic scatter, or there's something extraordinary about 1600, or maybe 1600 is just the tip of the iceberg because there are many more halos like that. Okay, our survey should be able to answer that question at least observationally, and theoretically people are working on understanding the environment. Okay, so just one last word about sort of other kinds of supermassive black holes out there in the universe. Quasars and active galactic nuclei out to very, very high redshift when the universe is very young. I have been known for many, many years, and you see some of gas being exploded or their radial lobes. And these are believed to be powered by central supermassive black hole. Okay, so understanding the evolution of how you form these first quasars and what do they become today. For example, these are probably progenitors of the black holes we're measuring in the local universe. Okay, understanding this ancestral relation is one of the most actively pursued field in extragalactic astronomy. And I want to just highlight one double nuclei, NGC 6240. It's a pretty messed up galaxy. But the lower box of the two blue points are Chandra detection of high X-rays. So this is, and they're separated by a few kiloparsecs. So they're still pretty far away. But this is believed to be a candidate black hole binary. So two black holes coming together, probably due to galaxy mergers, which is a common occurrence. Okay, so I'll come back to the binary part later. Okay, so just to summarize, these are a bunch of motivations for why, what we can learn from the most massive black holes and their host galaxies. Okay, again, as we look, the central black hole at each, at the center of each galaxy seems to be a ubiquitous component. So a galaxy is not just made of stars, gas, dark matter. Wherever we can measure something, when the detection is good enough, we invariably find a black hole at the center. And the hole itself, even though it's very confined to the center, it has huge impact on the appearance of the galaxy, the so-called feedback process. Okay? And these are, being the most massive, they're the most evolved system, right? Because this is how the Lambda CVM universe is built up, from small things merging to form big ones. So they probably carry the most amount of historical information for us to learn about cosmic assembly. Okay? And they are linked to quasars at high redshift, and sites of this kind of black hole feedback, which a lot of galaxy simulators are trying to understand, and the event horizon I mentioned. And toward the end of the talk, I'll talk about the binaries and the nanohertz frequency gravitational waves expected from these big black holes. Okay. So I'll just touch on a few observational challenges for finding these black holes and for measuring their masses. You would think the most massive things are biggest. They have the largest sphere of influence. So they should be the easiest things to find, right? Usually you find the big things first and then you look for the little ones later. But historically, it topped out at M87. And M87 was quite a special object too. So there were very few objects known, black holes known at that mass range. And there are a couple reasons for that. And I got into this because, not because I chose to become an observer, I was happily doing theory, galaxy formation, the CMB kind of thing. But I had a student, Mike Boylan-Colchin, this was almost 10 years ago now. We were trying to understand how the most massive galaxies were formed. So he was merging elliptical galaxies, slamming them together on a computer to form bigger ellipticals. Okay, in that set of simulations, we found that the standard scaling relations of galaxy properties, such as the Faber-Jackson relation, became, at a very high end, we started to see deviations from the canonical observed, you know, luminosity versus velocity dispersion and mass and so on. And one implication would be that the black hole galaxy correlation would deviate from the canonical slope, which I'll show later. Because at that point, I was wondering, well, you know, are there data supporting, you know, our theoretical prediction? And at that point, I realized that there were no data. M87 was at the top, and it was very sparse. And then I thought, well, okay, why don't we just try to find some? Since at Berkeley, we have access to big telescopes, and Gemini is a national facility, and also for Canada. So what happened was. That's how I started the observational campaign. And then that's when I realized that other people were really smart to avoid studying these big black holes, and there's a very good reason for that. Okay. And one is, as I said, massive objects are rare. So then to find the next big black hole, clearly they're gonna be more distant. Okay, so you need a larger volume. But then, of course, then the problem becomes, you need to resolve the stellar kinematics, you got to get spectroscopy very close to the hole. So the further out you go, you know, the angular size becomes smaller, and then it starts to become a little bit limiting factor. It, roughly speaking, the order of magnitude is not an event horizon, but rather the sphere of influence, okay, of the black hole. And that's just the radius within which the enclosed stellar mass equals that of the black hole. Okay, when you're very close to the black hole, obviously the hole dominates the gravity. As you move out, stars, dark matter is pretty diffuse there. Stars start to become more and more important. So there's a stage, there's that radius here where the two equal. Beyond that, the stars and dark matter start to take over. So if you want to study the black hole mass, clearly you need to look within the sphere of influence. So we need to resolve this with telescopes. We put in some standard numbers for a billion solar mass black hole. Okay, for a galaxy of velocity dispersion, you know, a big galaxy is about 300 kilometers per second for the stellar as a whole for the galaxy. At a distance of 100 megaparsec, the Coma cluster, for example, where big galaxies are, you need to resolve within 0.1 arc second. And I talked about micro arc second earlier, but this you need to do in the optical or infrared. As you well know, the Hubble Space Telescope has incredible resolution being above the ground, right? And they can reach maybe at best 0.1 arc second, okay? And the prior work on black hole measurements, understandably, all use the HST to obtain high signal-to-noise spectra. Okay, but it limits you to this distance will be very difficult to do with Hubble. But this was not a killer. necessarily. Okay. There was a second challenge, and that is you need to collect stellar light. Okay. But these massive, massive galaxies, which probably will host, right, these massive black holes, happen to have very diffuse stellar light at the center. Okay, and this has been known by the Newkirk team, Sandy Faber, and others for a while. And here is just a plot of, this is HST photometry now, okay, of the surface brightness of light in solar luminosities per parsec squared, some physical units, versus the distance radius from the center of each of a bunch of elliptical galaxies. Okay, so these are beautiful HST data, Lauer et al. Compiled. Those blue lines, which have the sort of standard cuspy right, slope towards the center, these are the vocal lower profiles you learned about, pretty standard for normal elliptical galaxies. But you look at the highlighted several giant ones, you know, some of them I just talked about, they have this very interesting flattening at the center, and in absolute numbers too, okay? Meaning somehow the stellar density is actually more diffuse, lower, ironically, in a big galaxy. Okay, of course, the outer envelopes, which most of the mass come from, dominate. So overall, they're more massive. But you look at the very central, and I'm talking about the central hundreds of parsecs. Okay, that's why you need very high resolution to see that. They have this core. These are called core ellipticals. Okay, I'll come back to the core. Why? This is, I think that by itself is a very good question to ask. How are the cores formed? What's flattening the core? Okay, but observationally, this is a killer because there's just not enough light. So the HST is not big enough to get you high enough signal to noise to target these. M87, you can see, is sort of barely what they could do at that point. Okay? So the solution is you need to go to ground-based, much bigger. You know, the HST is only 2 some meters. Okay, so 8 to 10 meter telescopes, but you need to use adaptive optics or fancy tricks to obtain HST-like angular resolution. Okay, so that's what my team had been doing the past 5 to 8 years now, is to not rely on HST for spectroscopy. And then, of course, TMT or GMT will be even better. Okay. So it was a combination of these two that made it really difficult to study these massive black holes before sort of the turn of 2010 or something. So, but with the ground-based big telescopes and good spectrographs, really, and the AO systems, we're able to have to discover some more massive ones. Okay. So in addition to the two I highlighted, we now have 4 known above 10 billion solar masses. Okay, so the question then becomes, how many more are there? Right? What's their number density? Is there top limit? Okay, so that's why I started this massive survey 3 years ago after we targeted COMA. It became kind of clear, you know, you got the low-hanging fruits. These are the very, 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 you know, there are only a few New York cities out there, so we need to target the smaller towns. So we decided that we needed to target the galaxies, select the galaxies more carefully. So I won't go into the details of the massive survey, but the idea is to pick the 100-ish most massive galaxies in terms of stellar masses, okay, within a volume. This is volume limited. So we are complete above certain stellar mass, and the volume is out to the volume of COMA. It's about 105 megaparsecs. Okay, and there happen to be about 116 galaxies. So we target with all sorts of spectroscopy and different wavelengths and photometric surveys. Okay. And so we have wide field, integral field spectrographs, which allowed us to get spectra in one shot. We get 700-ish spectra covering the whole galaxy. Okay, but that can't resolve. That allows us to study stars and dark matter distributions spatially, but that cannot. Each fiber is 4 arc seconds fat. Okay, so we need to resolve sub-arc second for the black hole, so that we follow up with very expensive Gemini or Keck IFU integral field spectroscopy that allows us to study. You can see that inside one fiber, we're able to obtain very spatially resolved two-dimensional velocity maps, sigma, velocity dispersion, and so on. We have also higher moments. Okay, so these galaxies are harder to, it just takes a long time to observe.
Where
Yes.
Where was your previous example, that Galaxy 1600, in this list of top 100? Where does it?
Is it yeah, right. So it is within. It's on the brighter side, but maybe number. Yeah, I don't know the exact. Maybe number 20 or something. Okay, so it's not the top five, definitely. They're all dominated by the coma. And also, we need the HSC photometry to get that light profile, as you saw. And we're also studying just other aspects of these galaxies, you know. So we have multi-wavelengths going on. And we have ALMA data coming in, which I'm pretty excited about, that we can trace the carbon monoxide CO. And we are seeing some beautiful CO. If that forms a nice disk, then we can use that as a new tracer. Rather than using stars, we use the CO kinematics to measure the black hole. It's always nice to have two different tracers. Okay, and very few systems have that privilege of having good measurements using different tracers. That would be a very good check on the system.
Can we go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
How do I tell this a black hole, and how do I measure the mass?
That's right, yeah. I wasn't going to spend much time. There's a lot of involvement in modeling it. As you can see, we have a lot of information, right? So each spatial sort of spaxel we have, the radial velocity, we have the dispersion, and our signal to noise is high enough that we get, so this is just a velocity distribution of the stars, we can get beyond the V and sigma, so we can get a skewness in the kurtosis. The H3, H4, they're called, you know, Gauss-Hermite moments. It just requires a lot of signal to noise. And the tails are very important. And the standard way to model this is to do the so-called Schwarzschild orbit modeling. So it's a static potential of black hole stars, stellar profile, and dark matter. And you can generate many tens and thousands of orbits. It's just a static problem, but it's a stellar dynamic problem. And then you project on the sky, and then you can predict the velocity distributions, and you use these many, many constraints to simultaneously obtain, you know, chi-square contours on black hole and the mass-to-light ratio for the stars. Now, there's a sort of big industry behind that.
Is there danger of being confused that it's not really a black hole, it's a stellar cluster or something?
That's right. So that's a very, very good question. I'll say that for these black holes we're studying, we don't have enough information to rule those out. The Milky Way black hole is a great example where people have been trying to, you know, clusters of strange stars, many, many, maybe some of you have written papers, you know, that all you're measuring is enclosed mass within some sphere, but their sphere is becoming so small that the black hole becomes the most mundane, least exotic explanation. Right. As you know, they are now trying to do general relativistic, because S2, one of the star around the Sagittarius Galactic Center one, has already made one complete cycle. And the peri gives them information about post-Newtonian orders.
Right.
Yeah. So I think if the Milky Way black hole is
black hole,
yeah, then we're gonna assume
it's
likely to.
So probably the biggest use of this is, I mean, assuming these things are black holes, you will get an estimate of population.
That's right. I'll show you those scale
units.
It's
following up by
PhD
or something to confirm it really is a black hole.
One thing though is
it's very likely anyway.
I think because you really can't hide any more light, right? HST photometry gives you, there's nothing additional. There's no cusp. So if you want to hide a stellar cluster, you better make it really dark. It would have been picked up.
So even in your data, it's quite, seems to be unlikely that these objects are stellar.
That's right. I think it would have, this is an enormous amount of mass here, the deficit here. Okay. So a 10 billion solar mass cluster would have shown in some way. Right. That's right. So if you would need to have a very exotic stellar cluster that's dark, basically. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, there are all sorts of stability issues, right? That's the problem. How do you keep a cluster not collapsing into a black hole?
In this massive survey, you're measuring the radial, you're measuring the spectroscopy down. How What physical distance from the
box? That's right. So angular sizes, we can get, depending on the distances, right? We can get down to, depending on which system, we can get down to about, you can see this one with NIFs, we can get down to about, on a good day, you know, with AO, probably down to about point, you know, you need a few pixels to resolve it. So about 0.2, 0.3 arc seconds, you can get some information.
So for example, at that distance, that's about, in terms of physical distance, that's about.
Right, so, you know, at our farthest end, 100 megaparsec, this would be a few billion, at least, right, the 0.1. I mean, this is a very, very rough measure, this one, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the, like NGC 1600 is much easier. It's 50%, and that's at, remember, this is at 17 billion. Okay. So for NGC 1600, we have resolution. We resolve about factor 5 to 10 within that, so we're pretty confident of that. Some are much worse, harder to measure.
But in that distance, I guess a stellar cluster would have to be incredibly dense to
you mean the enclosed mass within?
Yeah.
Right, so.
Stars, it would have to be very dense.
That's right.
So you can plot mass and enclosed versus radius.
That's right. We have that.
And yeah, presumably.
It shoots up like crazy. Right.
Have a graph of that?
Yeah, I can maybe find it later. Yeah, it's in our Nature paper in the supplementary. Yeah, that's actually a very important plot we always show. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And then dark matter, you can see how that comes in the outer part.
Right.
That's why we need a wide field spectroscopy to really pin down every. It's nice to break degeneracies. Yeah. Okay, so then I would like now to maybe to put these most massive objects I was talking about along with others, other supermassives, and to show you what can we learn from it, and you know, what are the demographics. And so this happened, people had, you know, in this sort of extragalactic astronomy had been very excited by the so-called M black hole, you know, M sigma M, whatever galaxy property relations. Because, you know, anytime you can find some scaling correlation, people get very excited and they dispute about its slope and the shape and so on. Okay? In cartoon form, it's sort of like this, basically. Whatever you plot on the x-axis, you know, it could be the velocity dispersion of, you know, so any kind of measure of the potential of your size of your galaxy. Could be the luminosity, stellar mass, and even a globular cluster, number of them, okay, versus the black hole mass. And those are hard to measure, as I have mentioned. So you need to measure these dynamically one by one. So now maybe about 100 are known, okay, after 3 decades of effort. And we're just adding at a high mass in. And what people have found was that the bigger galaxies host black holes. Okay, it's a simplistic picture here. And the mass should be the mass of the spheroidal component here. But for elliptical galaxies, I'm talking about that. There's no disk component. Okay, so it's basically the total mass of the galaxy. It's positively correlated. Of course, real data are messy. So we compiled then known. Okay, again, y-axis, they're not quasars or anything. These are all locally, you know, each one was painfully measured by different groups of the black hole masses using different tracers, stars and gas and masers. Okay? And the x-axis is, this is the sort of the common M sigma relation. In this case is the galaxy stellar velocity dispersion of the whole galaxy. Okay, and this had been known since 2002 by two papers, Ferrarese, Merritt, and Gebhardt et al. They first plotted about 20 of these points, you know, with some scatter, and they saw this positive correlation. There had been a lot of excitement about that, with a slope of about 4 or 5, depending on which team you looked at. And there's a lot of dispute about that 4 versus 5, okay? And this is the latest data as of 3 years ago, and a few more, some more points have been added. Okay, so our compilation showed that if you look at the red and the green points, those are early types, ellipticals, S0s. The blue points are spiral galaxies, late types. So Milky Way is, as I mentioned, is puny. Okay, it has a beautifully measured black hole mass, but the stellar velocity dispersion is actually very hard to get. Okay. And some of the big ones I talked about at the very high end, M87 and 4089. Okay, so the reason people were so interested in the slope, 4 versus 5, was because different galaxy black hole feedback process predicts different slopes. whether the black hole is imparting energy versus depositing energy versus momentum onto the surrounding gas. Give you two different slopes, okay? And it's based on very sort of back of the envelope calculation. But I'm not going to go into the slopes here, okay? Our fit is actually quite steep. The black hole is goes like sigma to the fifth power with some error bars, okay? But my point here today is not to talk about the details of the scaling relations, but you do see, right? This is over 4.5 deck of black hole masses from a million to 10 billion solar masses, a huge dynamic range. But 1600 sat way up there. And the one what we're writing up, 4874, if you recall, that was the twin of 4089. I don't know if you recall in the surface brightness profile, that had the lowest surface brightness. This one was really painful to study. We had to convince Gemini to give us hours and hours of integration time. Basically, you just got to collect a lot of photons. Okay. And our current measurement is, again, okay, way above. And our detection limit is much, much lower than that. I mean, there's always worry that we just aren't capable of resolving anything lower. But as I mentioned earlier, anything on the relation, we could have easily resolved. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the question, okay, so another reason this scaling relation or other similar relations have been used so much, had attracted so much attention is because also practicality. Since the y-axis is so difficult to measure, the x-axis is sort of is not easy to measure either, but you know, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, I cranked out a million of these, right? We know the galaxy velocity dispersion. You know, you can just go to the public data archive. So you can use this to proxy black hole masses over a wide range of redshifts and to study how black holes grow. Okay, and that's a game had been played a lot. So using this to convert more easily measured galaxy properties to the more difficult black hole, it is a very, very powerful tool for understanding cosmology, basically. Okay. So now our question is, is sigma a good proxy for black hole mass at the high end? Right? You can see a factor of sort of a 10 scatter. I think one way to answer, I don't have an answer right now, okay? I would just like to populate this with more measurements right now. I think we need to have more measurements. And another thing to note is as you merge galaxies, sigma doesn't necessarily grow very much anymore. You scramble the stars, and we don't know any galaxy much beyond 400, really. Okay, and it's possible maybe somehow the sigma just saturates, but as you merge two galaxies, if the black holes merge, you just add the mass. Okay, so sigma doesn't add, but the black hole may add, or maybe gas accretion, okay, is helping the central part to grow, but not growing the galaxy as a whole. So this is telling us something about really galaxy and all the good physics that's happening there.
Isn't it possible your observations are biased because you wouldn't have seen the smaller?
So as I said, not at the very bottom here, definitely. But I think we are comfortable with anything on the relation. We have probably about a factor of 10 dynamic range up there.
And
so had another way to say, had 1600 been, you know, five times lower,
right,
we would have, our data would have been able to get it.
And there's no other features of 1600 that make it look unusual.
Except that it overwhelms
one
galaxy.
So it's possible.
Otherwise, it's a quite just giant, very quiescent galaxy, yeah. And the environment is in a fairly normal group.
But what selection criteria did you use which might have biased?
Right, so as I said, that's why the massive survey, that's exactly the questions we were asking. That's why we had a massive survey, which targets systematically the 100. That's right, yeah.
What's the
time frame
for more data points?
That's right. So in fact, we just so part of the goal of the massive survey, which had been going on for about 3 years, and we're midway through, was to target systematically. So we have data for about 25 more, and the problem is we need four sets of data: high resolution, wide field spectroscopy, and photometry. So it had been taking us a while to collect all the data, and the data have to be good enough. And then the structural modeling takes some time on supercomputers to run and so on. So, but now with the data in hand, And the code is working very well. So in 3 years, we think we can add 30 more points at the high end. So that should really tell us what's going on. Again, this is another very popular relation, black hole, the same y-axis, but this is only for elliptical galaxies. Okay, versus the spheroidal part of the, this is a stellar mass now, okay, another measure. And this slope is about 1, okay? But people pay a lot of attention to this intercept, because it tells you what percentage of your stellar mass is in black hole, okay? And the various earlier papers, Herring, Ricks, and so on, that slope is typically 0.2% on average. Okay, so give me a stellar mass of the galaxy, about 0.2% of that is in black holes. That's the best fit line. Okay, but 1600 is here, and 4874 is here. So again, the black hole in 1600 is 10 times higher than it would be predicted by the mass of the galaxy. Okay, again, why?
And so I understand that's uncomfortable, but in what's going on. But why are you not concerned also what happens, say, at 10 to the 11, 10 to the 10 stellar mass in the galaxy? We also have almost 2 decades of
Right. Oh, we're very concerned about those. Okay. Yes. And then another one is back here. I didn't want to talk about it. This is kind of impinging on other people's field. But this.
Yeah.
Okay, this is extremely interesting. And since you ask, the triangles are masers. Okay. And very few galaxies have mazing gases in the eye. Some special condition must happen. But they have beautiful black hole measurements. You can see the error bars basically are non-existent. Yeah, because they form a disk, just sort of Keplerian. Okay, and there are about 7 or 8 measurements here. Okay, and then I think another 7 or 8 have recently been added. You can see they're all in sort of Cepher low mass galaxies. Okay, so they are very confining sigma. Sigma is very hard to measure for these galaxies. But there's basically a factor of 100. In that case, it's intrinsic scatter because the error bars are pretty much not dominating. And I think that population by itself is a huge question. Is there even any correlation? Okay.
So at that sigma, it looks like there's more than 1,000.
Cirsinus is well known, notoriously complicated.
But even the high one is difficult. It looks like
very difficult. But overall, right? So the population, the slope kind of works. I think the scatter is very, very important.
Yeah.
But to sort of understand the scatter, okay, but. Both ends, there are interesting features. And we would like to add more data points here. They're smaller mass, so we cannot possibly go to such. So Virgo, I'm involved with the Virgo cluster campaign, trying to fill in that part more. Okay. So just to give you an idea of, again, how one can learn about those observational scaling relations is back to the scatter. Okay, so I want to give you one example of a theoretical prediction that people had made for the black hole versus the galaxy mass correlation. Okay, and a bunch of people have played with this toy model, which is quite simple. Okay, so they say, look, this correlation you guys are observing, we can produce them with random seeds. Okay, so that the blue cloud is their initial condition. So they took some galaxy masses, and they assign them black hole masses without any correlation initially, square. Okay, so the black holes don't know anything about the galaxy. But then they let the galaxies merge according to lambda CDM merger rates, which we know pretty well, okay, based on cosmological simulations. The merger part is pretty good. And their rule of the game is, as I merge the galaxies, I add up the galaxy mass, I add up the black hole mass, which is quite simplistic, right? This is just so-called gas-free dry mergers. Gas can obviously contribute local gas accretion, but they say, let's just play this game. And then as time went on, at z equal to 0, they got the red line without any initial seed. And they say this is just a central limit. Mm-hmm. I guess as you merge, outliers get pulled. Okay, but one very strong, so different kind of initial conditions give you kind of different shape of red clouds, but the main conclusion was that At the higher mass you go, the tighter the relationship becomes. If this kind of merger is the primary way to grow black holes. Okay, you saw in our data that it certainly looks nothing like this. You know, if anything, maybe the scatter is the same, or it may start to blow up at a high mass then. Okay, it certainly doesn't get tight. So we can say we ruled out these models, which no one is surprised, right? Because this is sort of a toy model without gas accretion. But maybe you can treat this as another an indication that the local gas accretion is actually quite an important channel if we're growing black holes, not just the mergers, just adding them. Okay, that's clearly important too. But once you form a black hole, you can grow its mass further by gas accretion.
The higher there's less scatter at higher mass because those guys have experienced more mergers.
That's right. So each merger kind of make it tighter.
Where is the effect coming from the fact that there's fewer at the higher masses, so that somehow there's no so that there must be more scattered just due to the
You mean the Poisson? Yeah. I guess it really doesn't. I mean, there are fewer points up there. In fact, if they actually don't produce anything, the mass we're measuring, but that may be related to their initial seed, right? There's a lot of freedom in what redshift they start. So I think these curves all move up and down, but this tightening, I guess the merger really tightened the black hole rather than the Poisson statistic. I just want to show you another sort of state-of-art simulations, okay, called the blue tides simulation. And this is a cosmological simulation, hydro simulation, where they also grow black holes. And I just want to show you, they are able to make plots like black hole growth. So each curve here is a black hole that had formed in their simulation. But these are extremely expensive simulations and stopped at redshift 8. Okay, there are lower resolution simulations that had gone to redshift 0. And making various claims whether they can reproduce the M sigma relation or not. This is an active research going on here. Okay. So then I seem to have sort of, dismissed. I mean, you may become worried that the M sigma relation may not work very well. So is M black hole correlated with any other galaxy property, especially at a high mass end? And the answer turned out to be yes. We were fairly excited about that, and this is where I want to come back to the cores. Okay? So again, you can quantify where this light bends over by some parametric fit, and you can call it core radius. You can do a core circ, core de Vaucouleurs, or whatever. Okay, don't worry about the details, but there is a characteristic radius which you can measure, and this only depends on the photometry. So we measure that. And it turned out, if I zoom into the top 2.5 deck now of the black hole mass, okay, so this is not the whole figure, and these are the 20-ish known core galaxies. Remember, only the very massive ones show that core. It turned out the black hole mass is at a high mass, and if you just quantify it, it's better correlated with core radius than C, or M stellar mass of the galaxy. Okay, but of course the core is probably more smaller scale, right? So it's probably telling you something. I haven't talked about the core formation. So the core is probably formed by black hole. Okay, but this is just observationally. You can see 1600, 48, 74 are much happier on this plot. Okay. Another plot that we included in the last year's Nature paper was this one. I mean, we included both, but this one is what I think is very intriguing for theorists to think about. Okay, we just plotted the galaxy core based on HSD photometry. But the y-axis now, we're plotting another radius, which is the sphere of influence. Okay, so as I mentioned, since we model each galaxy, so we know its stellar distribution, we know its black hole, we can calculate the radius at which the two equal. And that's what the y-axis is from. Okay. And x-axis is just the HSD photometry, nothing to do with the black hole. It's just And these are, again, the sort of 20 core galaxies with dynamically measured black holes. Our systems are up here, and there's some other people's measurement. And the striking thing is the dotted line is the one-to-one, not just the slope, but amplitude. It's just one. Okay? Mm-hmm. And our best fit is statistically consistent with our sphere of influence being equal to the core radius. So basically, these two radii are and with very small scatter. Okay, 0.1 is the same. So not just the slope is one; is there's no offset. Okay, and I think this is probably the best evidence so far that the core is produced by the black hole. Okay, given this tight correlation, I mean, otherwise I think it would be quite a coincidence. Okay, and so, and you can see that those plots are pretty happy up there. So, what? So how do black holes produce these stellar cores? Okay, and this has been studied. You know, people have speculated for a while without having those observational results, but a binary black hole. Okay, so the idea is there's the three body slingshots. As two black holes come together as galaxies merge, they form a binary easily through dynamical friction. Okay, but then they can tighten their orbits by just, you know, picking out stars on radial orbits, okay, slingshots, and you can shrink the binary orbits until you run out of these low angular momentum stars. But because these stars are kicked out, you get a sort of a deficit in stellar mass, and therefore you flatten the inner profile. Okay, so for a long time, people have thought that this so-called dynamical gravitational core scouring is responsible for the cores. But I think our scaling relation at least shows that the black hole is doing something. Okay? However, I would say this may not be the only explanation. We and other people have studied what if a black hole binary merges, emitting gravitational radiation. Right. In most of the case, you don't have that symmetry, so your merged remnant black hole will have a recoil, carry away the angular momentum and energy, and that recoiled black hole can come back if it doesn't get kicked out of the galaxy, and it can gravitational heat the stars and flatten the inner core too. Okay, that's a possibility. I don't know if you can get such a giant core size as we saw. I think that required more study. The AGN feedback, I kept telling the people who do AGN feedback, is, can you make these giant cores by just blowing gas out? Okay, so a lot of people still think binary black hole scouring would be the best one. And very quickly, this is the velocity anisotropy predicted by our Schwarzschild modeling. Okay, and again, for each of the black holes, is the stellar anisotropy. So beta is zero if it's isotropic. You can see the inner part of the galaxy, this is very tangentially oriented. So the radial ones are indeed kicked out. Okay, this is based on Schwarzschild, the best fit solutions. The outer part is more radial. So I think any theoretical work should try to see if they can reproduce these features we see. Okay.
Is there any evidence of these measurements of galaxy that look up at a year? A merger relatively not too long after you're actually detecting or measuring. So what I'm asking, I'm thinking is, any of these processes you mentioned might take some dynamical time to actually just try to correlate the core with the size of the binary black hole or the merged black hole. But if you catch it, the galaxy that you have got
just merged,
yeah, just the merger not too early, not too far in the past, then you could catch something before it has relapsed.
Yeah, maybe the next survey. Typically, we try to avoid the very messy galaxies. They're very, very hard to study. Yeah, but I think being able to track that time scale would be very useful. Right now, I think just there's no human power to probe that parameter.
Is there a galaxy which doesn't have a core?
So all the blue ones. So the lower mass ellipticals
right. All
follow the so-called de Vaucouleurs, so it's cuspy inside.
Yes.
Okay, so there's only the masses. So those are the faint lines in the background where the run of the mill.
So do you have an idea of why it should be that this process of scouring out or back reaction is different?
That's right.
The heavy.
Or another way to ask, why should the lower ones be cuspy too?
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
And their part typically is gas. Okay, you slam together Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxy, you will form a normal elliptical with a core. With a cusp.
Yes.
Because of gas accretion. And then they have a burst of star formation. at a center. You form a lot of stars, and we see this in simulations.
And in bigger ones, that is
not. So what we think is, but these smaller ones start to evolve. Mm-hmm. So maybe they had a core form, but then gas accretion can always
fit
up the crust. Yeah. But that is a good question. I kept thinking, are there lower mass cored ellipticals, and how would they be different?
Do they exist?
I think there are probably a few, nothing, because the cores would be much smaller, and they're very hard to resolve. Yes, it could be a bias.
I guess maybe just back to Lisa's question. There are these claim systems over the years. I don't know whether how many of these have held up, but there are these claim systems where they claim to see the black hole. They claim to detect the black hole, the stars around the black hole moving at rather extreme velocity relative to the galaxy itself, and claim that it might be being ejected after merger. And
definitely not these dynamically measured black holes. Maybe some peak in some emission looking like a black hole. Are you thinking about supermassive black holes or stellar mass?
The supermassive black holes, I thought there were some systems where they claim to see two components, for example, in the
emission, whatever lines, right.
Where one looks like it's moving towards you at 1,000 miles per second.
Right, I think none of those truly held up.
None of those held up.
Yeah, right. It would be really nice to be able to see. I mean, you can ask, are there a lot of floating black holes out there? Okay, the problem is you need to know exactly where to look. Okay, we're always targeting the center of the galaxy. So it doesn't mean there are no black holes outside of the center, but it's incredibly, I mean, where is the black hole in the LMC, the Large Magellanic Cloud? It's a satellite galaxy, but it's this big blob of stuff over how many degrees on the sky and with no clear center. I mean, it's like, you know, really finding needle in a haystack. And no one's going to give you a telescope time to look for black holes by surveying that, you know, field. Okay. So I'm just going to spend, you know, sort of a few more minutes touching on this pulsar timing part, okay, about gravitational waves, and you all know a lot about this. So I just want to highlight that LIGO, obviously, in the higher frequencies, when you go to more massive black holes, the scales all got bigger. So merging supermassive black hole pair would give you nanohertz-ish gravitational radiation, okay? And this is now, and ELISA sort of in the intermediate regime. Okay, so pulsar timing would be probing really the mass range I'm talking about. ELISA is probably a little smaller, but still supermassive black hole binaries. Okay? So I'm now, I just joined the NanoGrav, one of the three PTA teams, the North American team. And the idea is to, rather than using interferometers on the ground, using pulsar timing precision. Okay, so these are very precise clocks, millisecond pulsars. So by measuring the timing residuals, fluctuations on the regular pulse from a collection of them, you can put limits on the amount of gravitational radiation from massive black hole pairs from the cosmos, really. Okay? And this has been going on for a number of years. There's a Australian team, there's a European team, okay? And I'll just show you, okay, just very quickly, their sources here are, they've been trying to look for two types of sources. Okay? One is called stochastic background, and that'll be just, you know, there are lots of black hole binaries, because hopefully out there, because galaxies merge, black holes come together. Okay, so you can kind of model this cosmological population from high redshift down to redshift zero. Each one contributes to a little bit of this background. So you can try to estimate the level of gravitational radiation from a cosmological ensemble of binary black holes. The other possibility, which they started to look at more recently, is due to individual events. They call the continuous waves. So like one of M87, for example, if it has a black hole, you could have a hot spot on the sky. And rather than finding the stochastic background, maybe you have a chance of detecting individual black hole binaries in the nearby universe. And this is the continuous wave limit. It depends on, you know, their limits depend on their analysis. Okay, so this is not a stochastic background, which is a little tighter. Upper limit is about 10 to the minus 15 for the strain. Okay, but this is for the continuous wave search. And there's some sky variations because they are more sensitive to the parts of the sky that's behind the pulsar. Okay, so there's some anisotropies in there. Detectors, really. And you can see where there are more pulsars, they got better sensitivity. Okay, but this is a two, just to show you, there are two upper limits right now in the order of 10 to the minus 14 at that particular frequency. And their window is about 1 nanohertz to 100 nanohertz or something. Okay, that depends on the cadence, the frequency they observe the pulsars, and the longest baseline, which is about 30 years for the best studied pulsar. So just give you a few numbers, how our project can be tied into this is, as you well know, that's the strain. Okay, depends on the distance and the chirp mass. So for sort of our relevant chirp mass scale, you know, I'm talking about billion, okay, and at their frequency 10 nanohertz, at about, you know, let's put it at 10 megaparsecs, it's on the order of 10 to the minus 14. Just to show you that they are approaching the amplitude expected from billion solar mass black hole binaries, you know, within this sort of local volume. Okay, they only have upper limits right now. But just to put the chirp mass in context with what we are measuring, the dynamical black hole mass I've been talking about, I can write this as a total M black hole, which is what we measure. Okay, frankly, if you had two black holes inside our sphere of influence, it's very difficult for us to resolve. We are measuring the total enclosed mass. Okay, so you could hide. You can ask, the Milky Way black hole had been studied so well, 4 million solar masses. Can that hide a companion black hole? And there are limits on that. It's, I think it's on the order of about a hundredth of that. So if it's a binary, has a secondary that's below 4 × 10⁴, I don't think they can rule that out. Okay, that limit is much worse for our black holes, but we can probe it. But I want to use pulsar timing sort of as a constraint now, okay, on the binary nature of these black holes we're studying. So you can write this as a total mass and the mass ratio of the secondary to the primary, and we can tell them what M black hole is. That's what we're measuring. We know what the distance is to our black holes, okay? Now they can say, search towards NGC 1600 or M87. I mean, what's the limit on the black hole secondary for M87? Okay. So they hadn't done that. That's what, you know, how I started to collaborate with them. I just show you a sky map of those purple circles are those 80 dynamically measured black holes I show in a M sigma relation. These stars are the various teams monitored millisecond pulsars. Okay, again, it tended to be collected as a galactic center, so it's more towards the southern hemisphere. That's why I would like to do a massive southern hemisphere survey, but that's a different story. Okay, ours is a northern hemisphere right now. But just to tell you where on the sky these things are, and the shading of the black circles is our predicted strain, given that distance and total measured black hole dynamical mass, assuming equal mass black hole. So that's most optimal. Okay, you get highest strain if you're in a binary at a given distance and given total mass, okay? But just to get an order of magnitude, you can kind of see that. Okay, and the last slide here. So you reverse the question, right? Again, so this is a project I did with a first year student, Caitlin Schutz at Berkeley, okay, last year. Again, these are those dynamically measured black hole on the M sigma relation Milky Ways here, okay? But this is our predicted, very simple back to the envelope, H using its distance, its total mass, and assuming X is 1. Okay, so this can only be, it can only be lower than this. But then you can already ask, given that the PTA upper limits, right, on the order of 10 to the 14th, so anyone on the right, if they were in an equal mass black hole, they could have been seen already. And there is none. Okay, so you can see 40, 89. Then you can turn this question around to say, what does this limit imply for X, right, for the binary ratio? So for example, these highest ones, they cannot host a black hole, secondary black hole, more than a few percent of the primary. If it's lower, then the predicted strain will be below this detection. You can see Milky Way is kind of outlier because it's extraordinary small distance, right? The strain is chirp mass over D, and D is tiny. So, you know, if they actually go to another order of magnitude, they are pushing it, or we are pushing it, you can actually probably put a meaningful limit on the Milky Way black hole secondary too. So my work here is to help them understand the sources on the sky because the massive survey is providing the hotspots.
Just to understand, you said in the Milky Way we're pretty sure there isn't compatible black holes. companion bigger than
about 1/100
1%.
That's right.
And that is from the stellar dynamics?
That's right, and within some orbit, obviously.
Yeah.
Right, if you put
so
it
the
some...
very near ones would somehow have been altered by the companion.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, and that's incredible. I mean, S2 gets to within how many? Somebody knows?
1,000
1,000 rotations.
Yeah.
Maybe a factor of 2
more. Right, so it's a very highly eccentric orbit, right? So, and most of the constraining power is from that star, I think. Right, they're monitoring maybe tens of these stars. So yeah, that's very powerful.
Your assumption here is the orbital separation is such that it gives you a nanohertz
gravitational wave. That's right. So there's a lot of assumption behind this. The orbital period is within that factor of 2, mm-hmm. 10 to the minus 9 to 10 to the minus 7, which is sort of their detection limit. So one can do this a lot better. I'm working with this is just back of the envelope. And you can actually go into their Bayesian method and folding in all the frequency dependence. And I think you're just going to refine these limits a little better.
I think for the very massive end, for it to be emitting at high enough frequencies for pulsars to detect it, it has to be quite close to merger.
That's right. And also, it's probably unlikely. Right? So as you know, that in their one of the parks, the PPTA science paper in their abstract, there was a lot of dispute with that sentence saying that their upper limit for the stochastic background had already ruled out most of the models. The nanograph team was very upset about that. And I think stochastic background, which I'm also working on, as you can imagine, the number of uncertain parameters, right? You got to build that up from population of dark matter halos, and then galaxy, you got to pin galaxy on that, and then for galaxy, you got to assign a black hole mass. And then this merger stalling, I mean, what if they're all stalled? If all stalled, then you wouldn't see a single one. Okay, or maybe they merge much more quickly. So it needs to sweep through that frequency window. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty. So to make that statement is pretty bold. I think they assume nobody stalled. There are a lot of assumptions behind that statement. But I think as the limit goes down, the stochastic limit is about here now. Okay, I think it will become more interesting. So the next 5 years, I think, will be a challenge for the theorists if they still don't see anything. Okay, so I just sort of not summarizing my talk, but sort of put this in a grander picture of, so this is a massive survey, which I'm spending about half of my time on. As I say, we're halfway through. And to answer Lewis's question, we have data now, and we're hoping to add more, about 30 more ultramassive, a few billion to whatever it's out there, okay, at that high mass parameter range. And it has a well understood selection criterion, so at least I'm hoping to get a black hole number density out of this. Otherwise, it's very hard to get that number if your parent sample is ill defined. Okay, and sort of its relation to the pulsar timing I mentioned, and then, of course, a big pursuit of cosmology is understanding how galaxies and dark matter halos, right, everything merge in the black holes. So that comes into the stochastic background of the PTA prediction. Okay, and then sort of the dark yellow are the sort of gravity site, okay, and I mentioned the event horizon telescope and how the massive survey will provide, hopefully, some more candidates for them beyond the Milky Way Center black hole and the M87. Okay. And then, of course, sort of there's a whole talk I could have given on just galaxy formation itself, the messy gas physics, right, understanding galaxies and clusters, sort of what astronomers have to try to understand. And there's still an initial mass function in massive galaxies I haven't touched on. And, of course, along the way, we're mapping the dark matter profiles. And one thing I didn't talk about is they want very coarse dark matter profiles too, okay, in addition to the core stellar distribution. Okay, thank you, I'll stop.
Any questions or comments?
I have 2 questions. So one regards the stalling that people have been talking about for ages. Isn't it true that all these very, very high mass black hole detections to some degree start to put limits on that idea that black holes are stalling at these separations, since it's very hard to grow them without any sort of merger, for them to merge, they clearly have to find a way through. So isn't this just a limitation of the theoretical models and the idealizations that are going into these calculations?
Right, so that's a good question. I mean, I will say it's uncertain right now. For one, is we don't know the number density very well. So it's a little hard to compare. For two is there are quasars. You know, they measure the quasar black hole masses very indirectly, not through the dynamical measurement, but through emission line broadening and so on. But, you know, they do some kind of proxy. There are quasars of billion solar masses known at high pressure 5 or 6. Okay, so so some of those could have been the progenitors of these. So maybe you don't need a lot of help through mergers if the number density is low enough, right? So then, because then you've got to explain how did those black holes form at redshift 6. How do you get to billion solar masses? But there's not a worry, apparently. Lambda CDM, you know, not like the Einstein de Sitter, right? Lambda CDM, late structure formation is not a problem. It has a Hess star because of lambda. And with gas, that's the big uncertainty.
That has a limit, right? So you can throw arbitrary amounts of gas on a
that's right. But apparently a billion is not such a big problem for them as long as the universe is not populated with them, right? It's always, these could be the outliers. So it's I think quantifying the number density as a function of redshift will really help. But just to add to that, I mean, there is no lack of theories for preventing, to go merging, right, to stop the stalling, right? You add gas, you get triaxiality, the potential. Many things help you merge. Okay, yeah, so stalling is just the stellar dynamical limit. So I doubt stalling is an issue, but if the PDA doesn't start to see something, there'll be fewer and fewer things we can use to get out of it.
Okay.
Oh, you've got a second question? Or,
So of course black holes are affecting the gravitational potential, and you've talked about some of these effects and how much stars you have, but they also affect they channel the radiation losses into different wave bands. So I was wondering whether your data can possibly distinguish those effects somehow. Maybe you just see these like cores and the drop in brightness simply because all the radiation now goes to higher energy because of the black hole.
That's right. So we have I had a line in the Chandra. So we dug into the Chandra archive, and about 34 of our 100 galaxies have Chandra data, and we have new Chandra data coming in. So there you can study the temperature profiles and X-ray luminosities and so on. I have to say most of these are quite quiescent. Okay, and we have radial data, right? So they're not quasars outpouring huge amount of energy. As you know, there are very few local quasars. So there are the gas had mostly been used up. But to our surprise, we found quite a bit of CO. Often you think these big dead red galaxies have no more gas at all. But there's actually some molecular gas. Some have emission lines showing star formation activities. So I think using the radial data may answer some of your questions. But if they have a radio emission at all, it's always fairly weak.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.